The first thing to say is that the culture of computer science is very distant from the culture of theoretical physics. And there's one crossover point in quantum computing, and which has developed quite a lot in the last few years. And prior to that, there were a few crossover points, but not too many. And we have extremely divergent vocabularies for similar but not identical ideas, so it could be a little confusing. And if I say something that sounds a little confusing, or just stop me and ask, please. If you know what I'm saying and you disagree, then just raise your hand and wait. I'm looking at you, Mark. And
Who's chairing?
I think it's chairing.
Oh, that's right.
Yes. And now another thing to say about computer science is culturally, computers. I'm going to talk about culture and ethical and political issues first, and then move into the technical discussion. I'll start with the non-technical part. So culturally, computer science has thought of itself from birth as a major new approach to explaining reality. And there's a notion that you could think of the universe as being made of information, that information science and computation provide an alternate way, an alternate method of explanation, and an alternate metaphysics, if you like. And there are many different variations of that, of course. And one of the things that's awkward for me is that I'm an extreme outlier within my field, that I'm not the only person at this table who has that property.
Well, the notion that the universe is made of information, I think that this has got no... this whole information theory came out of statistics, really. Right, wasn't that before computer science? I don't know what the relation really is. I mean, this...
Well, I mean, I would say that you could date the birth of computer science as a culture of explanation more or less to Shannon von Neumann-Turing-era thought, which is mid-20th century. Mm-hmm. You know, as always, you can push these things earlier, and you can find precedents in many, many ways, and I don't think that's fruitful for the moment. But that's certainly... The key here, though, is not what we think of ourselves as computer scientists, but the fact that we actually did succeed in speaking for the field in becoming extremely influential. And so the cybernetic metaphor, if you like, or the information science metaphor, as understood, which I think is a misunderstanding, to add just another layer of confusion, has become overwhelmingly influential and might be more influential than any other idea from the sciences right now in influencing politics, economics, ideas about personhood, psychology, all sorts of things. I think, for instance, the fact that in computer science we have this notion of Moore's law, where everything gets better and better at an accelerating rate, is part of what infected information science influenced economists to expand the idea of the invisible hand into the neocon ultimate faith in automatic improvement of perfectly free markets. Which is a level of faith that really came about after the computer metaphor had infected them historically, and the computer metaphor, as understood widely, and I think it, as I say, it's a poor understanding, is probably the most influential one. So one of the things that I've occupied myself with is arguing about what we should learn from computers and what sort of metaphor actually is appropriate. And maybe what I want to do is share with you just a few stories from that particular struggle that are relevant to this and to the topics we've talked about, although overall it's too large a topic to cover in one little presentation like this. But one question is, if you think of the world as a giant algorithm, then one might think of people as sub-algorithms, and there's this sort of sense of equivalence that comes about. And this has been enormously, enormously influential, of thinking of the computer as a metaphor for what a person is. And this is an idea that was around from the birth of computer science, but it really came to be first articulated in the 60s and 70s by people like Marvin Minsky, who was an important early mentor to me, even though I disagree with absolutely everything he said that doesn't have a formal proof. And I still adore him. And became super widespread, really, with the spread of computers as objects that people are experienced with. Now, let me just give you one example of a very simple way that the idea has spread, and I think this is going to be, this might seem like a little bit of a diversion, but I think it's relevant. In the early 90s, a Minsky student, who was a friend of mine at Stanford, got hired by Microsoft to make the Microsoft software more intelligent. And here the idea is that if computers are sort of less well-programmed objects in the same category as people, then if we can improve so they become like people, that would be a good thing. Every little step will make everything better. And so he tried to make computers like people in a number of ways. Some of the overt ways were ridiculous, which involved like the animated paperclip and all that. But the important ways were more subtle. So, for instance, whereas before you would manually ask the word processor to check your spelling, now it would automatically check your spelling and actually change what you'd written. And so this led to an interesting debate. If you're doing that, has the thing become smart and really improved your collective work, or do you have to bend over backwards and learn all sorts of new arbitrary junk in order to anticipate what this program is expecting from you in order to get what you want? So has it actually just made things worse? So it's a very interesting little subjective judgment. It's a difficult moment. Essentially every independent test I know of that doesn't involve Microsoft funding has determined that the program has made things worse. But when Microsoft funds the test, it shows that it's made it better. Now, there's another way to tell this story, which is going back to one of the founders of our field, Alan Turing, who had a thought experiment called the Turing test, in which you first ask a judge to distinguish between two people, male and female, and tell them apart without being able to get anything but text messages or some other sanitized communication from them. Then you replace the woman with a computer and ask the judge to do the same thing. And Turing's...
How was the woman?
As I recall, in the original, Turing wrote two versions of it, one as a letter to a magazine and one as a little monograph, and I believe in both cases it was specifically the woman, but I'd have to check that. I'm sure everybody here knows about the end of Turing's life and the sort of strange. It should be noted this was written during the final phase of Turing's life when he was being forcibly injected with female hormones and was on the verge of committing suicide by injecting cyanide in an apple and eating it and all of these things. But if you don't know the story, it's a whole other episode. But he was being forcibly turned. He was forced by the state to take on female sexual secondary characteristics by hormone injections as a sort of a treatment for his homosexuality, which was illegal. And I know that sounds just bizarre to state, but it's true. And let's just leave that aside for a second. But that's how we treat our founders in computer science. So anyway. So Turing's conclusion was that if the judge couldn't tell the computer from the person, then the computer has earned equal rights, and he had moral standing to make arguments of those kinds since he contributed enormously to Britain's survival of World War II in as good a state as it did comparatively, and by cracking the Enigma code. And also because he was being persecuted for who he was. But at any rate, this sort of trope of person-machine equivalence survived from that time. And it's kind of blended with the general notion of algorithmic equivalence to everything in the minds of many people who consider themselves influenced by computer science. Now, as a demonstration... Yeah, I think this sort of metaphor is wrong on many levels. In the case of the Microsoft word processor that retypes what one just wrote, The way in which it's wrong is that we can go back to Turing to find the error, which is that there's another explanation for a judge not being able to distinguish the person from the computer, which is that instead of the computer becoming elevated, more intelligent, or human-like, it's possible that the person made themselves into an idiot and became computer-like. And so it's an equivalent explanation, or it's as good an explanation, rather. And so so when you use the Microsoft Word processor, you might be making yourself into an idiot in just that way, bending over backwards to make it seem smart. And so fundamentally, there's an epistemological problem that you can't tell to what degree you're lowering yourself to make computers seem more human. Now, as we try to think about computation as a new approach to natural science, which is happening very prominently in biology, much less so in fundamental physics, although I have a feeling that we're entering an era where it will be increasingly important, then we have to start to ask a similar question of whether we can sort of love our simulations too much, whether there's a sort of a seductive and self-reinforcing quality to something that's actually running, on a computer that can catch us with our guard down and make and allow us to become stupid. And so, I could tell this story. The story I told about the word processor, I feel, and I told a sort of a very abbreviated version of it for economics, and I feel I can tell it in similar ways about many sub-disciplines of medicine now, and many other disciplines that are influenced. So I'm very concerned that sort of an impoverished version of the lessons from our field are being broadcast and becoming extremely, extremely influential. Okay, so... So with that as a backdrop, so our relationship to the social sciences is that you were talking about physics envy before. I think right now we're influencing you much more than you're influencing us, to be blunt about it, or at least I see that, and I don't like it. I would rather the flow was reversed myself, very strongly. I think we could use a dose of reverse flow, but it's very hard to start that. Let me talk a little bit about some of the issues that have come up and of a technical nature. The first thing I want to talk about is the question of variety, which has been brought up. And here we have a lot of different vocabulary for similar items. You were talking about, I think, innovation. And I sometimes use the word creativity, but I think we're talking about similar things. So, since the dawn of computer science, there has been an intrigue with setting up little algorithmic systems that spin out fascinating effects. And the game of life as an animation is one. Another one are the sort of Wolfram-esque patterns and by the way, the Wolfram sort of patterns started long before Wolfram and von Neumann had a Italian fellow in the basement making things that look very similar back to the very, very earliest general purpose computers in Princeton. These sort of things have been around for a long time, and they have this, the word that you come across again and again in the literature of them is, this is so provocative. And so we've been provoked enough, so now at this point after many decades, what have we seen? So the first thing is that we have a lot of what these sorts of systems are all share in common is that they're made of fundamental components that are all connected to each other on equal terms. For instance, they might all be on a lattice in which each link is equally important, or something like that. And what you get out of them is sort of very interesting aperiodic wallpaper with beautiful patterns. And what a believer in this system, people who believe this describes reality, will say, well, you just have to wait for very large scales, because if you wait long enough, all of a sudden, the right aperiodic wallpaper would be the one that spews out our very universe. Okay. Now, and that's a serious claim made by people, Wolfram anyway, and many others. Now, there's another way to build a little mini universe in a computer that spews out provocative things that behaves quite differently, and there's once again, a set of divergent vocabularies for this, but probably the most common one is to call them agent systems. And this one, instead of having every piece of state in the computer, and here I'm starting to use some of the computer science terminology, instead of having every piece of state be uniformly connected to its peers by some scheme, instead you have little bundles, and you say, this is an agent, and within the agent, the level of connectivity is very different and very higher than between agents. So now all of a sudden you have a system of, if you like, bridges and islands instead of a grid. Now, once you have these agent systems, you see phenomena repeatedly that's of a completely different order.
I don't agree with that statement.
Really?
Not at all.
Wow. Okay.
I mean, that's the whole idea of how you have emergent phenomena. I mean, you can take the game of life, right? And in the game of life, you have blinkers. You can have many complicated creatures.
Yeah.
And if you have an initial condition that's suitable, you can create arbitrarily a large number of these things, which then will interact in highly non-trivial ways. And then you can look at aggregations of the interacting agents. You can start to ascribe rules to agents that appear at a larger scale than
Well, give
life.
This a chance. Just kind of.
Let me because you didn't say how. So I think we accept that there are arbitrarily complex emergent phenomena from systems from cellular automata, which are systems on lattices, and I think there's even a proof of universality.
Right, and it was actually Alvy Ray Smith in 67 made a Turing machine in the game of life. So that's an old result.
Okay. So when you said.
But universality is very interesting because the thing. Okay, we'll go ahead.
Okay. So
I didn't understand the conflict. Can you?
No. So Jared had just said, and let's come back to the disagreement. Okay, if it is a disagreement. Okay, you had just said when you have systems in which you have, quote, islands and bridges, that is, very different kinds of connectivity,
right.
You get different and new emergent phenomena.
There's a clause I should add, which is the clause is at accessible scales. And that's a crucial difference. Many of these systems and all of the interesting ones are capable of universality in terms of Turing machine universality. And so, but the problem becomes
interrupt just a point of clarification because not everybody may know the terminology. You alluded to it. So the notion of universality of Turing is that any two computers of sufficient complexity are equivalent and that any one can be completely simulated on any other one. And that's the one that you use.
Well, can hypothetically be, and I mean, computer science hasn't integrated the problem of vast differences of scale yet, and so that's what I was about to get to. But yes.
Okay.
So there's a sort of, computer science is built out of, in its foundations, out of ideas of equivalence which are scale-free. So in other words, from a classical computer science point of view, if one thing can be done on an existing computer and another thing could be done on some other, you could do the same thing in a different way on another computer, but that computer couldn't be contained in this universe, but it could abstractly be constructed, those things would be considered equivalent. And so there's a very, very important question of scale. So for instance, you can specify, just any garden variety transcendental number or something, and then go down its digits and find our universe or something like that. And that it becomes an absurd argument if you go to arbitrarily large scales.
I agree with you that, I mean, that's not what we do in physics all the time. We make models at the scale or near the scale that we're interested in. Not everybody starts at the Planck scale and expects to get condensed matter physics out of it.
Right.
The Schrödinger equation.
Yeah.
Okay. That because it's just very, very far away.
Right.
And I agree with you that if you what you want to see is an emergent phenomena where you have degrees of freedom that are strongly interacting within each other and call those an agent, and loosely interacting with some set of other ones, then it might be easier to see that phenomenon as sort of model of that at that scale already, that you put that into the system.
Well, it's not just easier. I mean, it's transformatively easier,
but,
and that's the key point.
But I don't think that it's... I think that the point is that it can emerge out of a more microscopic model where you don't put that in. And
I'm going to argue with you on that, because there's something... And here actually, there is something a little fishy going on, which I don't claim to understand fully. So from the computer science point of view, which I would characterize you as representing right now, these fundamental equivalencies sort of erase the difference to a degree. You can say, well, you can build this level from that level, so there's an emergence there. But real emergence, let me say something about what I want from emergence. Okay. What I want from emergence is a non-tautological or sort of a sense of pseudo-similarity where something can beget something else that's not precisely the same as it. And there's a... I have to appeal to the literature and to my own experience that despite a tremendous amount of work by lots of people on discrete systems like the game of life, the variety of objects that comes out has been small, whereas starting with objects that connect to each other through some means that's low bandwidth and based on sort of pattern classification of each other, which you see in the A-Life community, you end up with much larger varieties, much more interesting varieties of effects very quickly. Actually, Mari, you derailed me just a little bit, so let me just find where my argument was for a second. My scratch is here. Go ahead.
Yeah, while you're doing that, I want to bracket this issue of scale, because I think it's related to this issue of external versus internal, which is something that I very much want to come back to. So I just want to...
Right. It absolutely is.
Also tie that to the issue of time versus timelessness, because there is, if I can try to say what I mm-hmm. What I think is key here, there is a certain style of argument which appeals to Platonism, appeals to the notion of timeless constructions of arbitrary complexity and arbitrary number of steps, which some people believe in, which has a certain force, and which is, however, opposed by arguments of the form of that's irrelevant because the number of steps required is too large to be practical, more than would fit in the history of the universe, done by a computer that fits in the universe, or something like that.
Right, and it's a question of whether you care about that sort of argument or not. Yeah. And that's a sort of a bias you can have or not.
Right.
There's a sort of a metaphysics you could have of just a computer big enough to calculate at the scale of the configuration space of the universe.
And whether you care about that issue is related to, I think, the issue of whether you think that time goes all the way down or is an illusion, and I think is related, and I think both of them are related to the issue of whether you think that, quote, the view from outside the universe is an appeal to some religious mysticism or is something that's useful in science.
Okay. Well, let me talk about time and computation. I'll get back to the agent thing in a second. So, getting back to the social stuff for a second, one of the arguments in the what's sometimes called the AI wars of what sort of metaphor we should get from computers has connected with the consciousness arguments, and that's one of the ways I ended up talking to physicists more, because I used to run into Roger Penrose at these consciousness conferences somewhat embarrassingly. I think we were both slumming or something. But anyway, and he was arguing his stuff and I was arguing about this. But I used to make epistemological arguments about time as part of one of the issues. The epistemological problem with time is very similar to the bulk object problem, which I prefer to call the gross object problem, to incorporate patterns of thought as well as bulk objects, which are both sort of mysterious emergent things. And that is that there has to be some perspective available in which you see these things. And this was also something that Stu alluded to. So the way I put it for time is, in order to refer to the present moment at all, even if you refer to it very, very imprecisely and very unreliably, in order for there to be any possible reference to the present moment, there has to be there's something funny going on. And so you can either argue all the way down to the Julian Barber level of sort of where you've precluded any possibility of time because you've decided that there's sort of an eternal set of nows at any rate. But as soon as you, if you don't go all the way to Julian's level, you have there's something very strange going on, and there either has to be some model of sort of like a consciousness as a tape reader moving along through reality, or some sort of a spooky non-determinism at the moment of the now. But there has to be something extraordinary about the now versus other moments in order for it to be referred to somehow. And that's an interesting thing to me, and that's an epistemological problem. And I don't think one can be so godlike and remote as to explain that one away. I think that seems important to me. And it might be a metaphysical point, but it seems to me one that can't be removed. That it shows there's a mirror of it actually in the origins of computer science. For instance, in information theory, the construction that we use to look at information involves senders and receivers, and this is a situation in which a sender and a receiver have met in the past and agreed on a code, and then they meet again in the future, and then information is sent over time, and then it's decoded, and then we can characterize many, many things about that. But there's an implied history. So there's a temporality in the very definition of information that's causal. And that's interesting.
What's the causal part of the journey?
Well, which is that the information would have been unintelligible without a prior event.
Okay.
And so intelligibility requires a causal structure.
Because otherwise you can't decode.
Right. Yeah.
Can I just insert a query there?
Yes.
If information is only meaningful in the context you just stated, what could our colleagues possibly mean when they say that the universe is composed of information?
I think that's a marvelous question, and it bothers me a great deal. And I think it's precisely a version of the question that Stu asked, which is, could a physicist make a perfectly correct description of a heart, missing that it's a heart? So there's when we talk about a level of description that's causally important, we're not talking about the description that arises out of the fundamentals. We're talking about another level of description. And that level of description is the one that is made of these gross or bulk components that have relationships with one another, and they have relationships of a form that they're intelligible, broadly speaking, to one another. And let's see. I guess, you know what, I think I'll stop there. That's a good point. Maybe more will come out in questions.
Okay, comments, questions? Steve?